Minnesota Public Radio's Main Street Radio coverage is supported by the Blandon Foundation, celebrating 60 years of dedication to strengthening rural Minnesota communities. Good morning and welcome to this Main Street special live from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I'm Rachel Reby. A group of elderly Catholic nuns is the focus of a landmark study on aging. The Nun Study, as it's called, has yielded some surprising information about Alzheimer's disease and provided clues on how to live longer, healthier, and more meaningful lives. The study began in Minnesota 15 years ago at Good Counsel, a convent for the School Sisters of Notre Dame in Mankato, Minnesota. Eventually, it expanded to nearly 700 nuns in seven convents, ranging in age from 75 to 106 years old. Sister Rosella Cruiser and Sister Nicolette Welter are participants in the ongoing nun study for Mankato. They've joined us today in Sioux Falls, along with Sister Carmen Berg, who has served on the leadership team for the project. Good morning, ladies. Welcome to Main Street.
Good morning. Good morning.
The director of the Nun Study, Dr. David Snowden, joins us from the studios of WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky, where he's a faculty member at the University of Kentucky's College of Medicine. Good morning, Dr. Snowden. Welcome to Main Street.
Good morning.
Listeners, our phone lines are open for your calls and comments.
Good morning.
If you are in the Twin Cities, you can call us at 651-227-6000. 651-227-6000. If you're outside the metro area, call us at 1-800-242-2828. 1-800-242-2828. Dr. Snowden, 15 years ago, you were an assistant professor of epidemiology at the University of Minnesota, struggling to find a research project. What led you to Catholic nuns?
Well, I had studied other religious groups, Lutherans in Minnesota, looking at diet and cancer, and I'd also spent several years out in Southern California at a university owned by the Seventh-day Adventists, and where we studied religious groups where they about half of them were vegetarians. We looked at the effect of diet and cancer, and it was really there, of studying Seventh-day Adventists, that I realized that studying religious groups were a real advantage for a population scientist. That's what I am. We like to study populations, where we study both the sick and the well and the people, if you will, in between, and with the idea of trying to understand what's causing disease and what's promoting health in populations. So that's what got me to consider religious populations. And when I was at Minnesota as a young assistant professor, I was really kind of looking around for another religious population, and the School Sisters of Notre Dame down in Mankato were one of the largest congregations in Minnesota as well as in the world, so that's what got me down to Good Counsel Hill.
And again, religious populations, because you have eliminated many of the variables? That's why?
Right. That's part of it, is that the sisters in this study, they didn't smoke, there was no heavy alcohol consumption, reproductive history is the same, and that's an advantage. I'd say that the light bulb went on in my head 15 years ago when I was walking down the hallway of the convent and looked inside a room, and there were various dolls who were dressed in different religious garbs, showing the change in the habit and so forth in the sisters over the last 100 years. And I asked someone, well, what's in this room? And they said, well, that's the heritage room and the archive. And I walked in and realized, holy cow, not only was this a defined population, but that also that there was historic records going back on these sisters to their, in many cases, their childhood. And so that gave us a window into the early life of the sisters, and that's really kind of missing in most of the research on old age and the problems of old age. Is what happened 60, 70, 80 years ago when the brain is formed and the organs are formed. So, and lastly, I think the big thing was the generosity of the sisters, that they were willing to be examined each year, to open up their records, their convent records, archive and medical records, and most importantly, they all agreed to donate their brain at death so that we could look at how the structure of the brain and the diseases present in the brain, how they relate to the quality of life and diseases like Alzheimer's, as well as living to old age. So it was kind of a combination of things. But
Sister Carmen,
it ends up being a I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, overall, it's a very unique window into aging and Alzheimer's. It's a model of aging and Alzheimer's, and we hope to get clues from studying this unique group of sisters that we can test in other studies.
Sister Carmen, you were the one that Dr. Snowden came to and made the request that he would be interested in studying the sisters at Good Counsel. Your reaction to that?
Well, when he first came, it was I saw that it was an opportunity, a great opportunity for us, because we too are people, interested in people, and as a community of School Sisters of Notre Dame, we have a lot of camaraderie with each other, and that is also a very important aspect of our life, that we get to know each other well and form very good relationships, not only with the sisters, but with other people. And I felt that a program like this, we would be able to not only help ourselves, but also to help so many people, because Alzheimer's was just beginning to show its ugly head among us. And so when Dr.
Can you tell we're in the flight pattern here at the Sioux Falls Fairgrounds? Go ahead, sister.
When Dr. Snowden came, I wanted to be sure that the work that he was doing was going to fit into our ministry of working with people, and that it was going to be one that would be a help to so many other people, and that the sisters themselves would be a genuine part of it and make their own decisions.
And they have become a genuine part of it. Sister Rosella, what did you think when you first were approached about participating in this study?
I was very happy that I was asked. And then when they asked us if we would donate our brain after we die, I was very eager to do that, because my own mother did not know me a month before she died, because she had Alzheimer's, I'm sure. And I knew that I could not give my other organs. They would be too tattered and torn at this stage of my life, but my brain would be possible to be used. And if I could just if it would just help one person to overcome Alzheimer's, I would be happy.
Dr. Snowden, you said making the request for the sisters to donate their brains was one of the more difficult things you ever had to do. You didn't go into this study thinking that you would get brain donations, did you?
No, when I started 15 years ago, we were really only interested in longevity and looking at their mental and physical function in late life. And so about 5 years later, then after I left University of Minnesota, came to University of Kentucky, we decided to add Alzheimer's onto the study. So I went to Mankato, Minnesota, to ask the sisters there first, because they already had a relationship with me over the last 5 years, and we had established some trust. Really, from the very first meeting I had with Sister Carmen, she was the first Notre Dame I ever met, and she made it clear to me from the very beginning that I couldn't teach these people as research subjects. I had to get to know them and let them get to know me, which was the best advice I'd ever gotten on doing human research. And so we, over the last 15 years, we've all become very friendly. But to get someone to donate any kind of organ, much less the brain, you've got to develop a trust, and people need to know the reasons why you want to do something like that. So, but the sisters, you know, I remember it was the December of 1990. I went to Mankato and was very nervous about asking them to be in the kind of a new part of the study, and particularly about the brain donation. And you know, I remember that. I finally led up to telling the sisters in a public presentation about, you know, well, we wanted to take our Alzheimer's research to the next step, and would they consider donating their brains? And boy, when I dropped that bomb, it was just quiet. I mean, Sister Nicolette, I think, was there. She can tell you a little bit about that, but it was just incredible silence. And then after maybe a minute or so, I noticed some of the sisters talking in the back of the hall, and then they all started talking, and over the months and years, we ended up getting nearly 700 sisters, Notre Dames, throughout the United States to agree to be in all phases of the study.
Sister Nicolette, what were you thinking when Dr. Snowden made that request? You had already agreed to participate in the study, but you didn't know it was going to involve that.
No, I didn't. No, I didn't, but I belonged to the program from the very start. And when he came to St. Paul, to Mankato, to approach that subject, I thought a while and I thought, what good is my brain going to do after death? I might as well donate it for a purpose, and that purpose was to study my brain and what it might tell those people who were studying Alzheimer's disease. So I was willing to give it right away. I thought, it doesn't do me any good after death anyhow.
Has it been, what's it been like for you to participate in this study? You're 93 years old.
Yes, almost 94. It was a delight. And in the beginning, I had to come either to Mankato or St. Paul because I was still working, doing my work over in Red Wing. And I had to come in for the program whenever he was here, when he was at the Mother House or in some place in St. Paul. And I really enjoyed being with the program. I enjoyed the testing that they did every maybe once a year or so. And those tests were of different kinds and interesting. So all the time I was in the program, I enjoyed every minute of it. And I always look forward to Dr. Snowden's coming.
Dr. Snowden, explain what sort of tests the sisters undergo each year.
Well, we're trying to test functions of the brain that are important in Alzheimer's, and obviously an important one is short-term memory. So we'll give the sisters a list of 10 words that they memorize, and then we do other testing. And then we ask the sisters, after about 5 minutes of distraction from other tests, what were the 10 words that they learned 5 minutes before. And this can give us, this is just one single simple measure of short-term memory, but that's one of the big things that goes in Alzheimer's. It's not long-term memory, it's really memory of what happened just minutes ago. We also have other mental tests that test orientation in time, where you just ask a person, you know, what is the day today, what's the date, where are you, orientation in place. And we have tests that look at visual spatial ability, the ability to draw geometric shapes of different complexity. And we have other tests of physical function, like we time the sisters as they walk 50 feet. We do we test their hand grip strength, their coordination, their ability to...
Sister Nicolette is gripping her hands even as you speak. She's practicing up for her next test.
Well, I'm sure she's got a strong hand grip. But overall, looking at mental and physical function that are necessary just for our kind of day-to-day activities, whether it's getting out of the chair, walking, dressing ourselves, remembering a few things, and knowing where you are. Those are the things we kind of take for granted, but those things get decayed in Alzheimer's, and that's what makes it so devastating. You're taking away some of the basic human functions that allow us to operate as independent humans, as well as language changes. We also check for a vocabulary and a variety of things to see how their ability to communicate, because as Alzheimer's destroys the brain, it's bad enough to have short-term memory problem. It gets really terrible when there's problems in communication. It's tough for the patient to not be able to communicate, and it's very hard for the loved ones to not understand, at least verbally, what the patient or family member is feeling. So
we have some questions that have been called in. We have Carol from Walker on the phone. Carol, good morning. Welcome to Main Street.
Hello?
Yes, Carol, we've got you on the air. Go ahead with your question.
Okay, I have followed your study, Dr. Snowden, for a couple of years. I've read about you. And my question to you is, and given this history, it will mean something more. My mother is 89, has Alzheimer's, and has lived in an Alzheimer unit for 3 years and was diagnosed in 1996. Her father died with Alzheimer's, and at least two of her sisters and a niece. None of them has had an autopsy, so we aren't positive, but there seems to be a bloodline situation going on in the family. My question to you is, with your intense study with the sisters, have you been able to look at bloodline affiliation with this disease, etc.?
Yes. Genes are a well-studied part of Alzheimer's, and that's one of the things that we look at. We take some genetic matter by swabbing the inside of the sister's mouth, the inside cheek, to get a little bit of cells from the mouth, and which we get the genetic matter from. And certainly we can see the effect of particular genes in our study. And what's going to end up is there's probably going to be maybe a dozen or so genes that are important in Alzheimer's disease. And there are a handful that are identified now, and there'll be more that'll be identified. And I think until it'll probably take another 5 years or so before these genetic tests become so good and can be used in coordination, where you really take a panel of genetic tests and see your kind of genetic propensity overall for the disease. But that we're not there yet. Where we are, though, is that if a family member does suspect to have Alzheimer's, a family should consider autopsy so that they can find out what the family member really had. Because what's going to happen in, say, Carol's family's case is that if it is Alzheimer's, then say 5 years from now, 5 to 10 years from now, there will be drugs that will be available, not so much for the treatment but for the prevention, drugs that you would take to prevent Alzheimer's over most of your life probably. And at that point it would be important to know, did they really have Alzheimer's, or was it another form of dementia that might have been causing it? So in a lot of ways, doing an autopsy, or also while they're alive, making sure they absolutely have Alzheimer's disease, of getting a good neurologic workup and a brain scan and a blood workup and a psychological profile done and so forth. It's important to know whether or not you've got it.
There is a genetic tie. Is that the only factor, though, in Alzheimer's?
Oh, no. I mean, I think there's been such a focus on genes because we can get genes just by, as I said, rubbing the inside of your mouth or taking a blood sample. We haven't really learned much about lifestyle and environment in Alzheimer's, because you can't ask someone with Alzheimer's, well, what did you do before you got sick? Before you got your memory problem, did you smoke? What was your occupation and so forth? And that's how we normally find out initially what causes disease. We go to bedside and ask people, what did you do before you got sick? And that's where the convent archives come into play, because we didn't have to rely on the memories of any of the sisters. We could go back to their convent archives and look at their early life records to get a sense of what they were doing years, or in many cases many decades, before they got their memory problems and Alzheimer's disease.
Let's go to Teresa in Minneapolis, who's standing by. Good morning, Teresa. Welcome to Main Street.
Hi there. Thanks a lot for taking my call. I actually had a question for both the sisters and for David. My question would be, I'm about to begin graduate school at the U School of Public Health, and I'd like to do research in nursing homes, specifically speaking one-on-one with residents. And I wonder, do you have any tips about what's a really good way, I mean, it seems like a really obvious question, but what's a really good way to approach research when you're doing it one-on-one with someone? What's a good way to explain things, you know, even on a personal level? Hello?
Doctor, well, you want to respond to that?
Well, I guess at the risk of taking a shameless plug at my book, you might want to look at my book, Aging with Grace, which really describes, you know, what happened over the last 15 years in this study. And I think a big part of it, doing any kind of research or probably anything in business, is you want to affiliate yourself with other good people that you can learn from and who can help you do what you're doing. I'm just one of many, many scientists involved in this study. So. And I think basically going back to Sister Carmen's advice to me 15 years ago of moving toward not seeing research subjects as just genetic matter or diseased liver or whatever, but as real human beings, and get to know them. I think that's a little missing out there in medical research, of actually connecting with the people that you study and not just see them just as their genes or as their disease.
Sister Carmen, you're nodding your head. That was very important for you when you gave the go-ahead for the study, that he did not see the nuns just as statistical information. Why was that so important?
It was so important to me because the retired sisters, to me, have always been models in my life. Wonderful educators and people and mentors. And so I did not want those treasured people of ours to be used as research subjects and maybe, in other plain words, as guinea pigs. And so I wanted them to be treated as the respected people that they are. And Dr. Snowden has done a wonderful job in carrying that out. I have to say that my fears today, fears that I had or not, or concerns, I'd rather say concerns than fears, have been totally taken away because he has truly measured up to what he said he would do.
Well, Sister Carmen kind of forced me to do that, and it was a great thing that she did it because it kind of got me out of my shell or my shy shell. And now it's just, when I go to the convent, like the one at Good Counsel, it's like going home to visit grandmother, except there's 100 grandmothers there. And it's a wonderful plus for me to be able to really be taken into their homes. And I've spent months and months in the convent and over the years. And and that's where the real core of what's important in old age. The things that are important in old age are different than they are in middle age and younger ages, and we need to learn more about how to preserve so that old age can have preserved the possibility of old age. Old age can be a wonderful time, as important and as fulfilling as any other stage of human development, but we've got to make some choices so that we've got the physical and mental fitness and also probably the social and spiritual supports to have a chance to live up to the promise of old age.
You're listening to a special Main Street radio show from Sioux Falls. I'm Rachel Reby, and we're talking about the Nun Study and its surprising findings about aging. Our guests today are Sister Carmen Berg, Sister Rosella Cruiser, Sister Nicolette Welter, and Director of the Nun Study, Dr. David Snowden. We invite you to visit the Main Street website to find out more about the Nun Study and this week's series of stories on aging. Go to MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. You'll be able to hear this broadcast as well as other Main Street reports. We'll be back with more of Main Street after this.
On the next All Things Considered, rural nursing homes struggle to find and keep good workers.
We have sign-on bonuses. We offer finder's fees. We have quarterly drawings of those people who have been referred over the last 3 months.
I'm Lorna Benson. We'll have the next in our Main Street series, Aging Gracefully, on All Things Considered, weekdays at 3 on Minnesota Public Radio.
And now here's Greta Cunningham with the latest news and weather from the NPR newsroom.
Thanks, Rachel, and good morning. Democrats are pushing a bill that allows patients to sue their HMOs if they are injured by a decision to deny or delay medical care. Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle says medical decisions should be made by doctors and not insurance companies. The Democratic proposal would allow unlimited awards for losses and suffering in state court and cap punitive damages at $5 million. Republicans are backing an alternative that would limit the damage awards to $500,000. Republicans are worried that the Democratic bill would force many small businesses to drop health care benefits for their workers. Moments after Juan Raul Garza was pronounced dead, President Bush was informed that the second federal execution on his watch had been carried out. The president was in the Oval Office when the White House counsel notified him of Garza's death by lethal injection at the federal prison in Terre Haute, Indiana. Earlier, Bush had rejected a clemency request from the convicted three-time killer and drug dealer. That marked the 154th time Bush has allowed an execution to go forward, including his tenure as Texas governor and last week's execution of Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh. Security sources in Yemen are confirming they've made arrests amid reports of an anti-American plot. They say seven members of an Islamic militant group have been rounded up. The suspects reportedly were targeting U.S. officials investigating the bombing attack on the USS Cole. In regional news, the number of people hurt in the deadly storm that moved through northwestern Wisconsin's Burnett County is rising. Three people died and 14 others were injured when a twister touched down near Siren. Four people remain hospitalized. At least 100 homes and businesses were destroyed or extensively damaged. The village is getting cleanup help from at least eight other counties. The forecast for Minnesota today calls for cloudy skies, cooler temperatures statewide. There is a chance of showers and thunderstorms in the north today. Highs ranging from 68 to 78 degrees. Right now in Sioux Falls, it's clear and 61. Rochester reports sunshine at 61 degrees. Duluth reports sunny skies and 63. And in the Twin Cities, sunshine with a temperature of 65 degrees. That's a look at the latest news.
Welcome back to this Main Street special from Sioux Falls. I'm Rachel Reby, and we're broadcasting from the fairgrounds, which has been transformed into a silver city of Airstream trailers. 2,500 people, most of them senior citizens, are expected at this international gathering. We're talking about the remarkable study of elderly Catholic nuns that has yielded important information about aging and Alzheimer's. Sister Rosella Cruiser and Sister Nicolette Welter are participants in the ongoing study. They're with us in Sioux Falls, along with Sister Carmen Berg, who has worked on the leadership team for the project. The director of the nun study, Dr. David Snowden, joins us from the studios of WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky, where he's a faculty member at the University of Kentucky's College of Medicine. Listeners, our phone lines are open for your calls and comments. If you're in the Twin Cities, you can call 651-227-6000. If you are outside the metro area, call us at 1-800-242-2828. Dr. Snowden, before we go any further in the program, I'd like you just to capsulize what you consider to be the most significant findings so far in the nun study.
Well, I would say the probably the key one is the importance of the early development of language ability and the brain in early life. I mentioned the archives in the first half hour, and what we found when I got into the archives 15 years ago in the convent was that these handwritten autobiographies that the sisters had written when they were in their early 20s, and what we found was that those sisters who could pack a lot of ideas into their sentences, could communicate a lot of ideas, that they had a dramatically lower risk of Alzheimer's disease 60, 70 years later, and they also had dramatically less Alzheimer's disease pathology actually in the brain. So, and other studies have shown worldwide of a relationship of education level to Alzheimer's disease risk, that the higher the education, the lower the risk. So, and it makes sense. Alzheimer's is a thinking disease, that if you could develop your thinking ability as optimally as possible, that it may take more Alzheimer's disease in the brain to cause the symptoms of Alzheimer's later on, and that's partly what we have found. So that was in early life. And in late life, what we found is that strokes, that particularly small strokes, in combination with Alzheimer's disease in the brain, that they can precipitate the symptoms of Alzheimer's. That there's a significant number of sisters in our study that when we look at their brains, we are surprised that they have lots of disease of Alzheimer's in their brain, but they were not showing any symptoms or hardly any symptoms. And what we found is that remaining stroke-free, not getting a stroke, seems to be one way to potentially prevent or at least postpone the symptoms of Alzheimer's. And it makes sense. I mean, probably the last thing you want to do is add on another brain-damaging disease on top of Alzheimer's. So be it a head trauma or a stroke, those things appear to be able to precipitate, to push the Alzheimer's brain over the edge and the person shows symptoms. And I'd say another finding we found was the importance of diet, and this was specifically based at our studies in Mankato. Years ago, we took blood samples from all the sisters in participating in Mankato, and then we waited many years, and then we looked at, and we found that those sisters who had high blood levels of a vitamin called folic acid, which is found in spinach and multivitamin pills and leafy green vegetables, that those who had high levels of folic acid had less damage to the brain when they had Alzheimer's disease. And that's important because this replicated another study done at Oxford, and we know that folic acid, this B vitamin, is very important in the development of the brain in early life, and our studies and a growing number of now are starting to suggest that folic acid may be important in maintaining the structure when it's under attack from Alzheimer's. And lastly, this is a finding that just came out a few weeks ago, relating more to longevity, is what we found that those sisters who were writing very positive emotion sentences that are very hopeful, happy, optimistic, future-oriented when they were in their 20s, that they lived many, many years longer. And so we've really looked at a variety of factors, with Alzheimer's being a big part of it, but also as well as longevity. So Basically, to sum it all up, that you know whether or not you're going to get Alzheimer's is a consequence of a long chain of events, and there are links with genes in early life that are part of that chain of events. There are links related to the development of the brain, the maintenance of the brain, medical care, and so forth. And what we want to do is we may not be able to change our family history, but we certainly can buckle our seatbelt up, eat a lot of fruits and vegetables, you know, try to take care of our brain and try to take care of our body. And that's, I'd say, the big conclusion from the study is the importance of the early life factors of developing the brain and then maintaining the brain throughout the rest of the life.
Sister Nicolette, we have heard Dr. Snowden talk about what he has found out from the study. You're 93 years old. What is your secret for living a long, active life?
Well, as he just mentioned, a basic or balanced meal is one important thing. And exercise is very important. And he asked me when I started to exercise, I do a lot of walking, or I did a lot of walking. And I said when I was 70 years old, I started. Of course, being a principal in a school, you did a lot of walking through the school, too. But I really started doing my walking when I was 70. I was still doing work out on the missions. And I usually walked about 3 miles every day. And I think exercise is very, very important to a healthy living.
Well,
and of course, living in community and being with the sisters and engaging in projects with them and visiting the sick, all those things helped to make me know the importance of living a balanced life.
Sister Rosella, what would you add to that?
What was that, please?
What would you add to secrets for living a long life?
Besides what Sister Nicolette just said, I believe much in having a hobby. And one of my hobbies is reading. And I read about a book a week. And I read most of the current magazines. I also read, I also do counter cross stitch as a hobby. I used to sell it, but now I just give it for gifts. And I think maybe the thing closest of all is my relationship with God. Because I think these 70 years I've lived a divine romance with Jesus. And that has helped me.
Thank you, sisters. Kara Hetland is in our audience. Kara, you've got a question out there?
I do, Rachel. This is Don, and he has questions about what he's noticing in his own mother.
Good morning, Doctor. My mother is 81 years of age. And I've noticed the last couple of years, she's becoming very forgetful of many things that we should not forget, as well as she'll often tell me something several times in the course of a day. And I'd like to know, how do I deal with that as her son, and so that I make her feel positive, but yet reinforce her that she's not getting into Alzheimer's? I don't know. How do I deal with it, I guess, is the question.
Well, I mean, one thing, and you may have already done this, is that someone who's having memory problems. We all have occasional memory problems. I can't remember a face or a name, and that's just normal for all ages. But it's when the short-term memory problems of what happened just a few minutes ago become increasingly worse. That's when red lights should be going off, and you really need to get that person to a neurologist to get a complete workup and to make sure to find out what is exactly the problem. There are some things that can be done in the early phases of Alzheimer's, but in fact, you first thing you want to make sure is that they actually have Alzheimer's, things like depression and medication problems, nutritional deficiencies can cause what look like the symptoms of Alzheimer's. So number one is make sure what you've got, and that's getting the person who may have Alzheimer's to a neurologist for a complete workup. And if there is a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, then I think it's just a lot of patience, and it's also trying to work with what you've got. It's again, it's that kind of maintain whatever function you've got. And so I think Nicolette could, you know, maybe Sister Nicolette might tell a little bit about what she does. She has a sister who, one of her siblings who was a nun who also has the symptoms of Alzheimer's, and she has her own little plan, and maybe Sister Nicolette would like to.
Sister Nicolette, what would you add to that? How do you deal with your sister?
Well, I visit her about 6 times a day, and I feed her at all meals. At present time, she eats very, very little, but her mind is very clear, yet she can answer all my questions, and she asks me questions, and she likes to have us with her, and I think, don't know whether she realizes that she has symptoms of Alzheimer's. We don't tell her, but she watches television during the day, and she seems to enjoy it. But she spends much of her time sleeping, too, because it seems seems to be very tired all the time. And I enjoy going with her, and she enjoys having me with her, too.
So stay connected.
Yes,
exactly.
We do.
That's right. It's very easy with Alzheimer's to kind of withdraw from the world because it's hard to keep involved in the conversation. It could be kind of embarrassing, and that's probably the worst thing you can do. Mm-hmm. So Nicolette is there, you know, having observed her over the years, she's very patient, but there's also a little bit of tough love there of trying to keep the person connected to the world, and patience goes a long way. And,
we're going back to the phones now. We have Jean in St. Cloud. Good morning, Jean. Welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for taking my call, and thank you, Dr. Snowden, and the School Sisters of Notre Dame. I was educated by them, so I know how loving and giving they are. My question is, my husband, when he was 50 years old, sustained a closed head injury and now traumatic brain injury and now has a lot of cognitive dysfunction. And I'm wondering, what are his chances of getting Alzheimer's, and what could I do to prevent it? He was 50 at the time of the accident. He's 52 now.
Well, it's hard to comment on an individual case. Just in general, I would say that there's excellent evidence that a prior history of a head injury does increase the risk of Alzheimer's later on. But this is kind of one of those links in the chain. You can't do anything to undo the head injury when he was 50. But certainly you can make sure that he doesn't get more injury to the brain. So, make sure his blood pressure is normal, that he's not smoking, that he's exercising. You want to reduce the risk of stroke, of further damage to the brain from other things you can control. And also just making sure, again, being part of being connected to the medical community, that his progress, that you know what his memory and mental abilities are now. So if he has changes in the future, then one can be alert to them and try to do something about it.
The Nunn study has captured the imagination and attention of the public. It's been featured in Time Magazine, National Geographic, Newsweek, Nightline, CNN, and CBS Evening News, The Today Show, even international coverage. Sister has a copy of Time Magazine right here. Dr. Snowden, why all the attention? Were you surprised by it?
Yeah, I guess I was very surprised by it. It's been kind of brewing over the last 10 years, and I think part of it really, I would give a lot of credit to Sister Carmen, because that she really forced me to get to know these sisters, and inadvertently, that ended up putting a real human face. That was her advice to me, but that pervades our entire study, that you get to know these sisters if you're going to work with this in the study. So I think it's the human face, and I think also you have sisters like Nicolette or Rosella, who are in their 90s, who are really give you a kind of a gold standard. They show you that there are other ways, that old age does not have to be a downhill, that it can be one of great promise. I mean, Nicolette, for example, is the sole survivor of her class of 16 young women who became sisters. And in fact, there's a chapter in the book that's about Nicolette, which is called The Last Nun Standing, which is about why was she in these seemingly similar young women, why was she the one that survived to the end and is in great shape? And that's what we're trying to figure out, is it's what's explaining not just Alzheimer's, but we're also extremely interested in successful aging of the other side. I mean, you have a sister in Mankato, Sister Esther, who is 106, and you know, enjoys every day, and is just a wonderful example. And I think it's I think that's part of it. It's not just about disease; it's also about what's possible. And I think that your guests there show you what's possible.
The book entitled Aging with Grace, What the Nun Study Teaches Us About Leading Longer, Healthier, and More Meaningful Lives, was published in May. Actually, half of the proceeds from the book are being donated to the School Sisters of Notre Dame. Is the book about the sisters, or is the book about the scientific discoveries, Doctor?
Both. I mean, what I've tried to do is to use the stories of the sisters, like Nicolette and Esther and others, to give you a sense of where they came from, and also what was in their history that might have explained their different fates. And so much of it reads like a novel, and then kind of, to be honest, once I kind of hooked the reader with a particular couple sisters that I'm telling them about their story and so forth, then we'll tell the reader a little bit about what's going on in their brain and what we're finding out in the laboratory. And it also gives a little bit of an insight about, you know, what scientists do. It isn't all just behind the microscope. So I guess the bottom line was I wrote the book because I wanted to share more of the lives of these women with other people. And and it certainly has captured the imagination of many people. And it's been successful so far. I'm happy I did it.
Sister Rosella, you say that you are a great reader. You read a book a week. Tell us what you think about Aging with Grace.
When I received it, I was so happy that I could have my own copy. And I wrote to Dr. Snowden. I told him it's a bestseller. It really is good. And I tried to get all my friends to buy it. I've been giving it to at least four people so far. I think it's wonderful.
Sister Nicolette, as the doctor said, Chapter 2 is all about you, The Last Nun Standing. What does it feel to take a hardback book and open it and read all about your life?
Well, to tell you the truth, I kind of knew it was going to be in because he asked me about my life, and he conversed with me several times on it, and I felt kind of big about it. I felt kind of great about it, and everybody, you know, all the sisters and all the people, they write and tell me about the book, and they mention me especially. And that makes me feel kind of good because I feel that I'm doing some good for the people out in society through the book that he wrote. And I think it's written so well. The book is written so well. Everybody will enjoy it. So people, be sure to get a copy. Nobles and nobles have them.
Ladies, you've done book signings, haven't you?
Yes.
Tell me about that, Sister Carmen. Is this just kind of a whole new world of good counsel now? You have sort of celebrities as part of the sisters?
It certainly has. And I met several people in Mankato who said, you have put us on the map through the nun study. And it's really true. There have been so many communication ways that we have become known through the book, through the magazine, through newspapers and so on, through our local radio and through our local TV station, that it's remarkable. And many people ask us about the nun study and want to know more. And if you still want to know more about School Sisters of Notre Dame in Mankato, we have a website that is ssndmankato.org.
Great. That's one way you can find out more about that and about the nun study. Both those links are on our webpage as well, minnesotapublicradio.org. Dr. Snowden, in our closing minute, tell us what's ahead for the nun study. It's been going on for 15 years. It is by no means over, though, is it?
No, it's going to go on for, we hope, many, many, many years. We're in the process now of trying to permanently endow the archives so that the brain material, the autobiographies, all the material that we've gathered can be used for decades to come by researchers and scientists, so that these women can keep teaching through even after they die, that they can keep teaching. This the sisters being in the nun study is so consistent with their life of giving and educating people, and that's why I think we've gotten on so well. And we will continue to follow, and particularly, you know, looking at getting out into your hundreds and with good mental and physical function, the successful aging, where we will continue to focus on, as well as personality differences. You can see the three sisters in front of you are really, you know, quite different personalities. They're not stereotypes and come out of a cookie cutter pattern or whatever. And we want to look at the individual personality differences and their effect on longevity in the future too. So we've got, you know, decades and decades of work to do. And we're looking forward to our association with these wonderful women.
And 294 of the original 678 participants are still alive in the study. So
that's right.
Still a lot of work left to
Lots
do.
Lots of work. That's right. The story is continuing.
I must tell you, when the New York Times came out with the article on the study, pupils from all over the country called me and congratulated me because of that study. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful.
Ladies, thank you so much for being here. Our guests have been Sisters Nicolette Welter, Carmen Berg, and Rosella Cruiser of the School Sisters of Notre Dame, and Director of the Nun Study, Dr. David Snowden. This special Main Street broadcast is a production of Minnesota Public Radio. Our engineers are Cliff Bentley in Sioux Falls and Scott Liebers in St. Paul. Our producer is Sarah Meyer, site producer Kara Hetland, and executive producer Kate Smith. We'd like to thank Tom Tisdale and his crew for making this broadcast from the International Airstream Rally at the W.H. Lyon Fairgrounds possible. We invite you to visit the Main Street website to find out more about the Nun Study and this week's series of stories on aging. Go to MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. You'll be able to hear this broadcast as well as other Main Street reports. The address again, MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. Minnesota Public Radio's Main Street team consists of 12 reporters at NPR bureaus across Minnesota. I'm Rachel Reby.
Minnesota Public Radio's Main Street radio coverage is supported by the Blandon Foundation, celebrating 60 years of dedication to strengthening rural Minnesota communities.
7 minutes now before 12 o'clock, and this is midday here on Minnesota Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Gary Ankton. Terrific program from Sioux Falls. By the way, if you'd like to hear that program again, check out our website, MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. Full week's worth of middays, always available at our website, MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. And don't go away now. We have a new documentary coming up over the noon hour today. It's called The Global Politics of Food, latest offering from American Radio Works, the documentary arm of Minnesota Public Radio. This one will take a look at genetically modified crops, the issue of seed patenting, as well as a report on the fair trade movement, all part of the Global Politics of Food. That documentary, our feature presentation today over the noon hour. Right now, it's time for the Writer's Almanac.
Here's the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 19th of June, 2001. It's the birthday of author Salman Rushdie, born to an affluent Muslim family in Bombay in 1947, educated in England, worked as an advertising copywriter for 10 years, before he came out with Midnight's Children in 1981, which won him the Booker Prize. It's the birthday of Tobias Wolff, born in Birmingham in 1945, joined the Army when he was 18, was sent to Vietnam in 1967, learned Vietnamese, went off to Oxford University, wrote for the Washington Post, then began writing fiction. His first was In the Garden of the North American Martyrs in 1981. Tobias Wolff, who said, "You could say that all my characters are reflections of myself, in that I share their wish to count for something and their utmost confusion as to how this is supposed to be done." It's the birthday of the film critic Pauline Kael, born in Petaluma, California, 1919. Her father ran a farm. He was a Polish Jew who loved going to the movies. Went to the University of California, Berkeley, published her first movie review in the magazine City Lights, contributed to dozens of magazines, ran an art film theater in Berkeley, broadcast reviews on the radio, but in 10 years, she had made less than $2,000 from reviewing films. She went off to New York City, freelanced for magazines, and began reviewing for The New Yorker in 1968, where she stayed until she retired at the age of 72 in 1991. Pauline Kael, who said the first prerogative of an artist in any medium is to make a fool of himself. It's the birthday of the novelist Laura Z. Hobson, born in New York City, 1900, famous for her second novel, came out in 1947, Gentleman's Agreement. It's the birthday of novelist Elizabeth Seifert, born in Washington, Missouri, 1898, author of more than 80 novels, most of which have women doctor protagonists, and by which Elizabeth Seifert managed to support her family and her husband, a disabled veteran. And it's the birthday of the philosopher and mathematician Blaise Pascal, born in Clermont, France, in 1623. He invented a digital calculator, he studied hydrodynamics, invented the syringe, and developed the principle for the hydraulic press. Pascal's principle in physics says that if a fluid at rest in a closed container has pressure applied, the amount of pressure applied is applied equally to all parts of the fluid and the walls of the container. Pascal, who also said, "The heart has its reasons which reason knows nothing of." Here's a poem for today by David R. Slavitt, entitled Hell. Hell is very much like heaven, except that the furniture there has somehow been misarranged. A pipe in a wall is leaking. The plumber again has failed to show up. And the freezer compressor is shot, so that food is defrosting. And where is that serviceman? Such trivial things, surely the great-souled and wise seem not to mind, while we, other and lesser, but honest about our feelings, do we know better? And must we keep still? Don't we have the right to complain? But where is a pen that works? And where are my glasses? A poem entitled Hell by David R. Slavitt from Falling from Silence, published by Louisiana State University Press, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, produced by Minnesota Public Radio, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International, made possible by listener support at this public radio station, technical direction by Mitch Hanley. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Regional broadcasts of the Writer's Almanac are supported by Marquette Banks, your community bank, offering a broad range of financial services for your business and personal needs.
It's a minute now before 12 o'clock, and we're going to break here for station identification on midday. And then, when we return, we'll get to the new American Radio Works documentary called The Global Politics of Food.
Legislative leaders get together once again to try and end the budget stalemate. I'm Kathy Werzer. We'll have that story and all the news tomorrow on Morning Edition from 4 to 9 on Minnesota Public Radio, KNWFM 91.1.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio. Sunny sky, 65 degrees at KNWFM 91.1, Minneapolis and St. Paul. Sunny to partly sunny through the afternoon. High temperature probably around 75 degrees tonight. Partly cloudy with an overnight low 50 to 55 tomorrow. Chance for rain in the Twin Cities with a high temperature in the low 70s.